Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Appreciate y'all taking time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort who are with us live, if you are so inclined, you can go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or better yet, there's a question you would like for us to address our guest, that is the perfect place to do it, because we'll be watching that as the show goes live. And if you've got to take off and take care of some honeydews on the list before the show's over with and you want to catch up on what you missed, remember, just take a moment to subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Spreaker, or whichever aggregator you use, and that'll give you the ability to listen to this and future Midrats at your own leisure. And today we're going to talk about a recurring subject with a recurring guest. Really looking forward for today's conversation. But for those that have watched the news recently, you'll know what I mean when I say strap on your leather jacket, get your SM6 plush toy and whatever else you have in the bag you collected going from vendor table to vendor table, because today we are going to talk with our returning guest, David Larder, the National Warfare Reporter for Defense News, about things that he saw over at the Surface Naval Association Symposium early on this month, and a lot of other related issues in the surface arena. David, always great to have you over on Midrats. Welcome aboard.
Hey, Sal. Thanks for having me on board.
And kind of to kick things off, I know a lot of our listeners have heard of it, but most of them haven't been there. And the Surface Naval Association, I guess if you wanted to look at it as the SWO version of Tailhook meeting up with Comic-Con in a trade show. I guess our submarine guys have BubbleCon or whatever they do as well. But that is a yearly gathering for the surface community and all its associated friends and members. And take for a minute and describe for the listener what the SNA symposium is and why it's important, not just for media professionals like yourself, but also those in industry, concerned folks, or even people that are serving on active duty themselves.
Right. So I will take this one piece at a time. I think the one thing that you can always expect from Surface Navy is you'll get a feel. If you're talking about the main presentations, you'll get a feel for what's going on in the Navy and where the values are and what's important to the Surface Navy. I mean, if you think back in just recent history when Sir Fort Copeman was there, and this caused a bit of a stir, but he outlined that I think this was 5 or 6 years ago. This is when the Surface Navy was kind of at its peak usage, talking like 9-10 month deployments. And basically his point was that we don't have to keep these ships going, so we're sending them out in a subpar material condition. And that ended up causing quite a controversy. But as we know, as things kind of progressed, I mean, he was right. And when Mattis came in the door, that was the thing that he harped on the most, is essentially, the material condition of this equipment that we have been operating for years and years and years in the war on terror is just subpar. So, I mean, that was big. If you remember a couple of years back, Tom Roden rolled out distributed lethality, which has now morphed into distributed maritime operations. It was a concept that was birthed in the surface Navy. This, how do we spread out Chinese, ISR assets to make it so it's harder to find our individual ships. And if they do find our individual ships, they've only found small elements, not the whole force. And they network that together. That was all birthed inside the surface Navy and has since been adopted by the force writ large and even the joint force. So from the perspective of, the bigwigs that are there, I mean, you get a feel for where the Navy's going at surface Navy. And I think even more important is the networking opportunity, right? It's all your old buddies from USS Last Ship or USS First Ship that you get to kind of see and interact with. You know, I was just in for 4 years, and I always see people I know at SNA. And even having gone the last few years and just reported on the surface Navy as closely as I have, I start to see COs that I've met or interviewed or went underway with, and you know, we can connect that way and maintain those connections. It's always kind of a who's who in the surface Navy. And then finally, for industry, of course, you want to be part of that. You want to be in the conversation. And I think from, you know, what's on the floor at the booths in the aforementioned bags of swag, you can see where industry's head is. And industry is oftentimes responsive to what's going on in terms of the, you know, the what we talked about earlier, what's going on in the Navy and where's it headed. So today, or this past, you know, SNA, we saw a lot of unmanned surface vessels and concepts for unmanned surface vessels on the floor. We talked a lot about frigate with various contenders. There's an interesting aspect there, but I'll kind of leave it at that. I hope that's a long explanation for what was a very succinct question.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the what I see as a new openness among the leadership in discussing the fact we don't have enough ships to do the job. I mean, is it just me perceiving that, or have you noticed that they're much more inclined to say we need more ships, we need more ships, we need more ships?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think like we talked about earlier with Mattis coming in and talking about readiness, you know, that was Mattis's main priority, was recouping some readiness that had been bled away by just repeated deployments and not enough training. And then obviously inside the lifelines of the Navy, we had those terrible accidents in 2017 that we talked about when I was on the show last time. So readiness and getting that right was going to be the focus. Now, with the change of administration and with Acting Secretary Modley, he's been a lot more concerned with restarting this conversation about a 355 ship Navy. And we could have a whole show just talking about that. But ultimately, he's tapped into, I think, what really is an administration priority. And certainly now with Robert O'Brien and National Security Advisor, it really is an administration priority to up the ship count. I mean, this helps him electorally because he can go to the shipbuilding towns and say, look, we're getting jobs here and we're getting stable jobs. Because it was a promise on the campaign trail, so it's another promise cast. So I think with Acting Secretary Mobley coming in and kind of saying it's okay to talk about this, we do need a bigger fleet, I think that's changed the game a bit. And, you know, I think CNO has his due, all due credit to CNO as well. He's been willing to back him up on that and say, you know, we do need it. But I think, you know, this gets into the readiness conversation again. I think there's always going to be a natural tension between readiness and investing in the future.
Yeah, I have to give credit to the acting Secretary of the Navy, Modley. He did. He leaned into the skid early. He's like, okay, I work for the boss. This is the boss's priority, so I'm going to chat it up. And it's been interesting. And I think he's been more aggressive in that conversation than what is broken out into the general media. And I saw something, and I believe it was an interview that you did with the CNO. And I personally like when I see a little bit of lack of sync. Lack of sync is probably a strong word, but there is a competing priority between getting that 355, which is a political goal. You're right on, and you would expect that because Secretary of the Navy position, it is a political position, and everybody should remember that. And that doesn't necessarily mean bad. That's just, you know, part of its flavor. But Cito Gilday, he came out in an interview recently, and which is an argument that I've made a little bit when we're talking about if we're going to have static budgets or nobody's going to break up the proportion of the pie and things of that manner, is are you willing to trade additional ship numbers to repurpose and recolor that money, put it towards maintenance and readiness? And Cino Gilday has talked a lot about that, I think rightfully, whereas that civilian side and the acting Secretary of the Navy has really been pushing the numbers wide. Do you see that as really being a conflict or just two individuals talking about equally important priorities to make sure they get into part of the conversation?
I think there is a natural conflict here between maintaining readiness and growing the fleet. And the Surface Navy has tried some creative solutions here, right? They tried to lay up all the cruisers and say, well, we'll modernize them and we'll bring them back when we need them. And that was a creative solution to accept, I think I'm going to steal a phrase from our mutual friend Brian McGrath here, some selective hollowness to, in order to maintain that force structure, select it. And if we needed it, we could hire the sailors or we could, you know, build the sailors in and bring them back as we needed them. But I mean, that was a solution to maintain force structure, and it did not fly with our friends on Capitol Hill. Randy Forbes at the time didn't like that idea because he didn't like the idea. He didn't trust the Navy would ever bring them back. He thought they would just try to decom them. And to be fair, he was probably right. Ultimately, because, you know, these things get made budget to budget, right? So one thing sounds like a great plan, one budget, and then the next budget comes along. It's like, we could really save more money if we just decom them and we're not using them anyway. So, yeah, there's just always going to be this natural tendency from even just – not even just growing the force, maintaining the force that we already have. I mean, just look at the Royal Navy. I mean, they're talking about cutting more escorts. I mean, they have cut their escorts to death. I think they have, 19 ships, 19 escorts at this point? I mean, this is the cycle you get into, and you just cut force structure, you cut force structure, you cut force structure, and eventually, to maintain readiness, eventually you don't have much force structure left. And I think with the – I think what our mutual friend Jerry Hendricks might argue is, no, you need to – readiness and a bigger fleet are roughly the same thing. I mean, it can be the same thing. You need to grow the force because if our missions aren't going away, right, if the missions that these ships aren't taking away, I mean, nobody thinks that North Korea is not going to want to shoot a missile anytime soon, so we need to have that standing DMD mission, and that drives force structure. So if they're not taking away – missions, they need the force structure. But, you know, so ultimately, yeah, there's this natural conflict between maintaining readiness and force structure. But I think what Gilday really advanced at SNA was this idea that maybe you just need to have a grand strategy conversation at the OSD and National Security Council level about how we're spending our money. Now, that lets the Navy off with a multitude of efficiency sins, I would imagine, just saying, oh, throw money at the problem. But I mean, if you think that having, that the Navy is the best way to deter conflict with China or with Russia, then you need to invest in the Navy and perhaps take risk in other places. So I think that was what he advanced at SNA.
Well, how much of you had a couple of recent articles that kind of get into this. One is on the unmanned vessels, unmanned missile boats, and the other is on the comms question, both of which are tied closely together. You know, if the panacea is more unmanned ships, which a huge expense for the Navy, of course, is personnel, part of the question then is, well, how are you going to talk to these things when they're off doing whatever it is they're doing? So, where does that stand in your mind right now?
You know, that's my number one question. I mean, without getting into – I mean, I was never cleared at the top secret level or whatever, but without getting into clearance stuff, you have to manually change the certain things about how these thing, how our ships communicate every day. You know, Link 16 doesn't just automatically run. It requires some hands-on work to keep it running and keep it secure every day. I don't know how that works, right? Do you? I mean, I don't know how you automatically tell a network or an encrypted network, how do you automatically tell it, okay, well, now we're using this set of frequencies. Well, now we're using this set of frequencies. Like, I don't know how you do that. And I don't want to confuse anybody here, but ultimately the point is, I don't know how you maintain a secure, encrypted communications network without operators on board to manually manage that crypto. And why would you have your crypto just off floating anywhere, and the Chinese can just be like, oh, hey, look at this thing. Why don't we board it and see what kind of exquisite communications gear we can rip out of it? I mean, all these things seem to be critical questions. How do you maintain a comms network? I don't know. I don't know how they do it with the drones, honestly. You know, because they have these loitering drones that go up for 36 hours at a time. I don't know how it works there. Maybe they figured out a hack or some kind of system. But ultimately, we're talking about these things going out for weeks at a time. And I just don't know how that works. Second of all, I don't know how you keep them reliable. You know, obviously that's going to be engineered into them, but then you have a very reliable machine with exquisite comms gear on there. And are we now saving money? I mean, it feels like when you talk about these things, the costs start adding up to the point of, okay, well, where are we saving money? I don't know. I don't know if that's a confusing answer, but you know.
No, I think you hit exactly on is the follow-on question that still isn't answered. And my illustrious co-host kind of stole my question, but that's okay. I'm going to double down on it. It's not just
for me.
The fact, and we great minds think alike. It's not just, you know, how you keep a comm leak going. We could get ITCS on here to talk about what it takes to keep an FFG under comm suite running for a while. But
right.
There's also the issue that remains unanswered. If you're developing this wonderful system for peacetime, and you're going to give a non-zero percentage of our warfighting capability to these systems, how are you going to operate and fight them in a non-permissive EW environment? Whether you're talking about access to either the electromagnetic spectrum or access to satellites, we have in the last few decades become complacent and a bit arrogant, I think, in our access to bandwidth. And because I've done this since I've left active duty, when I asked this question, well, you know, we'd have to, you know, talk behind the cipher lock. Well, I remember what the conversation was when I could go behind the cipher door. And I don't think that we've really thought, if we're talking about peer and near peer competition, what that means. I know about my co-host, I saw a little bit of it when I was a kid before the Soviet Union decided to implode. But back in the day, nobody assumed that we were going to be able to talk to each other or link to each other or navigate from point A to point B with anywhere in the electromagnetic spectrum. That's a 21st century challenge. I hope we got the smart people working on.
Yeah, I know the Air Force is doing some work in this direction, and that the Navy has tried to hook into it. There's any number of solutions you could do. You could do relay drones, but again, those relay drones have to talk to each other. Maybe you could do laser comms, but how many drones do you need doing laser comms? Because lasers diminish through the atmosphere, right? You can't, and the bit rate diminishes even if you have, say, rain or fog or mist or sand or any of the things you might normally expect in the places that we operate. The bit rate diminishes. And then the question is, how many drones do you actually need to spread the fleet out like you're talking about? So So you could do it that way, but then you're talking about an enormous expense of laser drones that go up in the air. And then where do you put them? I mean, you would need a drone carrier to put that many drones up in the air. So anyway, all that to say, we just kind of were reinventing the wheel for this comms network. And, you know, CSPA, Brian Clark had a study out recently where he says that maybe that's not a great investment. Maybe we should be investing more on, you know, decision aids and some money in networks, but more decision aids for the individual combatants. If you're going to be operating alone and unafraid, maybe we invest there. And frankly, I don't think that makes a lot of sense, because, I mean, that seems to be built into the DNA of the Navy, right? You have a ship off on its own, performing a mission, and the CO doesn't always have, you know, the access to his admiral to ask him, what should I be doing now? You know, that's relatively recent when we're talking about the arc of maritime history.
Yeah, we used to I used to fantasize in the days when we could go to sea and nobody would talk to us. And, you know, get the orders would read, go to X and act in the best interest of the United States. But, you know, that, as you said, that in recent years, that changed considerably. So I'm not sure if the current COs have the kind of freedom the guys, or could have the kind of freedom given to them, the people back, you know, 100 years ago. When was that? Maybe even longer than that. Had, you know, when they went out to, on extended trips. Ever since the invention of the radio, we've been in trouble.
Right.
I was going to ask another question about the other link that has been hot topic for us. I know we've talked to Sal, the other Sal, about the sea lift issue. Did that get addressed at all during the surface Navy thing?
Yeah, there was some talk about it. Certainly, I went down to the NAVSEA booth and heard from their program manager, who's kind of looking into all the main aspects of it. And frankly, I mean, honestly, they don't have a plan. They had a plan that they threw together with the sea lift the nation needs. But as it has been, here's why I don't believe that they have a good plan. That OMB memo that I reported on over Christmas, they had a $1.4 billion submarine tender that they were trying to get OMB to sign off on in the sit-up, which we need sub-tenders. We really, really need to replace those ones out in Guam. They're not doing well. The Frank Cable just came back into service, and apparently that was supposed to be a 2 or 3 month overhaul. It ended up being over a year because the boilers are in bad shape. And by the way, I just said boilers. We're still using steam on those things, and there's just not enough steam engineers left in that are of seagoing age left in the country to man those things. So we need a sub-tender, but I mean, ultimately, and it was going to be part of this common hull auxiliary platform, multi-mission platform, CHAMP. But they put down a program that the White House scoffed at. They're like, we're not spending $1.4 billion on a sub-tender. And you can hardly blame OMB for that. Maybe if they'd all gotten together and had a decent plan to replace the sub-tender, everybody would be on the same page, and they wouldn't be having this weird back and forth memo that got leaked to the press. And so all that tells me is that, you know, when it comes to recapitalizing the sea lift and the auxiliary force, they don't seem to have much of a plan that anyone has agreed on. And this common hull auxiliary platform, it just isn't flying with our political masters, because they don't think the money is there. So, you know, I'm not encouraged by this. I'm not encouraged by any of it. And I'll tell you what, that turbo activation went terribly. So yeah, you talked about it with Sal, the other Sal. But I mean, 40% of the fleet is ready to go. I mean, how is this not a crisis now? The PACOM commander is doing his war plans on the basis of a certain understanding of how many sea lift ships he has available and immediately to search. And it's not going to be there. It's just not there. The assumptions that they're making are not matching the current readiness. So, yeah, I'm not convinced the Navy has a good plan. They say that they are committed to an affordable recapitalization.
Yeah, I would encourage the listeners, because you know all the David Larder groupies are coming to listen to Midrats, who may not have listened to all of Midrats, which they should, of course, subscribe to the free podcast so they get every one. But I would encourage the listeners to go to our Midrats that we did a couple weeks ago. Actually, it may have been last week with Sal Mercogliano about the merchant ships and the auxiliaries, the unsexy but important. And, you know, Eagle One, we've been talking about this. We've been doing Midrats for 10 years. I think we've been talking about this for 9.5 years. And David, I mean, you're spot on, and you see this up close and personal. The whistling through the graveyard that we're doing, and you know, you just brought up the submarine tenders. Don't even get me started on why we need to bring back destroyer tenders if we really want to be serious about Westpac. But all the other auxiliaries, the cargo ships that we're hoping to, our maritime prepositioning ships, it is like a untended cancer, and eventually it's going to metastasize. And this isn't something that you can fix in 3 or 4 months. I feel sorry for the program managers you had to talk to about it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I can tell you, it didn't feel like a priority, and it doesn't feel like a priority. And frankly, it's not about – everybody always says this, like, well, we're not going to have a major war with Russia or China. Okay, well, they said that before World War One, but let's just assume that that's true. How much can they get away with is the question in their head. Okay, if we don't want to have a major war with the United States, how much can we do? Can we invade Taiwan? Can I bulldoze my way through the Suwalki Gap if I'm Putin, and can they stop me? Because frankly, that's the calculation, right? How quickly can we get there to stop them or react to it? And that line, as we're talking, for as much as DOD talks about gray zone and needing to compete in the gray zone, and everybody wants to compete in the gray zone, this is the gray zone, guys. This is it. Figure out how to deter the adversary from doing the war in the first place. I mean, this is what you do. And if they call our bluff, like, well, you know, it's not like they can surge a major naval force. They can't resupply it. They can't. It's not like they can surge a major armored force. They can't even get it across the water. So I don't know. It's frustrating.
Well, let's talk about another fun part of the. I saw somewhere. I think it might have been one of your articles that we've got. Might have been you talking to the CNO about the like we have 68. Destroyers that have come online, and we're working on 66 LCSs. What are we doing with these 66 LCSs? Is that going to count against the 355? Or are we going to get a bonus for having those guys around?
Gosh, I got to tell you, getting all my getting me spun up. I went to the LCS mission package, the program manager, and it is a very good dude running it, and he certainly is passionate. He cares a lot about it. I'm frustrated by a lot of things, and LCS is really one of the prime examples. The mine hunting mission package should be online in the next couple years, but at what rate and how fast can we get them out there? I don't know. I kind of have this open question in my head about whether we'll field the ASW and mine hunting mission packages before we start decommissioning LCS. And I think the winning side of that bet is that we're going to start decommissioning LCS ships before we actually field all the mission modules for which they were designed. We're talking about stuff that should have IOC'd a decade ago, and it hasn't yet. And we're talking about having 66 of them to do what? I mean, yeah, at a certain point we need gray hulls in the water to do low end missions, but these things are not well suited for those missions either, right? They guzzle gas. They were built for speed. So anything over essentially a crawl through the water, which is good for ASW if they had any ASW sensors, you're going to start guzzling gas, and so can't keep up with the carrier. So even if you strap missiles on it, it seems to be, you know, of limited use in a carrier strike group. It guzzles gas. So unless you have them forward deployed, it doesn't make a ton of sense to use them to do like FON ops and, sort of partner engagement missions that other small ships have done. Certainly that was the Oliver Hazard Perry's, the bulk of what they did before they were decommissioned early. What are these things good for if they don't have their sensors? I mean, we're going to have all these ships, and it doesn't feel like there's a ton of urgency behind fielding these sensors that go with them. Yeah, they're working hard on them, but it should be – you're talking about 66 ships, right? I mean, this should I think they have, 35 that they're building – and then they've got the 15 frigates. So anyway, all that to say, we need to start fielding these sensors, and we need to make it a priority, because otherwise we're going to have just a bunch of ships with nothing to do and not enough crew to man them.
And that's a perfect lead in to revisit something you mentioned before, regardless of what that fleet number is. There's going to have to be an asterisk by it. And my feelings about LCS for the listeners is well known. I don't need to replow that field much, but one of my major critiques had been when people would say, well, that's not in accordance with the con ops, or that's not what we're supposed to do it with. My response has always been, listen, when war comes, and it will come, missions will need to be done, and the fleet commander will have a certain number of ships to do that mission. And LCS is going to be those ships. And they will be sent in harm's way. We will send that ship and those sailors to go do missions that you're telling me is not on the PowerPoint slide. Well, I don't care. History shows us that whatever century version of PowerPoint slides are, you know, if you're there, you'll go do the mission. And, LCS has been suboptimal to use an understatement there. And I was thinking of that when my initial reaction, Brian Clark and Tim Walton's CBSA study, where they said, you know, we are misaligned against the Chinese threat. And my first thought is, we've known the Chinese were a growing threat for a couple of decades at least. Why do we find ourselves in 2020 saying that? Back up for a bit and for the listener, outline from the surface perspective, Brian Clark and Tim Walton saying in 2020 that we are misaligned. What are those major areas that they're arguing that our surface fleet is not ready to go to Westpac on?
Right. So I think it's virtually everything about the way this is kind of the thing that's been mind blowing to me covering this is virtually everything about our fleet. Admiral Gilday has a really great quote. And I think he sees this problem very clearly. And so I think that's a good thing. We have a CNO that has some pretty clear ideas about what's wrong and where we are. He has a line. They said something along the lines of, we can't keep wrapping $2 billion hulls around 96 missile tubes. That is the fundamental problem I think the surface Navy had, is that it has, the missions haven't gone away. As we learned in 2017, we're putting an enormous burden on essentially a destroyer force. The cruisers are seeing declining use because they're getting old. Some of them are in layup. And getting modernized, and they'll be around, but they are going to have a very narrow mission, I believe. My belief is that they'll have a very narrow mission, and that's to defend the carrier. They'll use those missile tubes to defend the carrier. And that's what they've always done, but I don't think we're going to see a lot of cruisers doing independent beaming ops. that hold down a lot of these everything else other than defending the carrier missions, that's all going to go to the destroyer fleet. But these things cost $2 billion a hull. That is a fundamental misalignment. We've got to get cheaper ships. And this frigate, I think, sounds like it's bringing that into alignment. And right now, I think I'm trying to recall I think it is that 60 number. I think that's the requirement for small surface combatants. I think it's something like 100 large surface combatants, 100 plus 100 large surface. I don't have the document in front of me, but the point is, it's the number in the most recent force structure assessment is needs to be reversed, and I think the Navy recognizes that. They need more small surface combatants, less large surface combatants, more cheaper hulls around more missile tubes, I think, is the ultimate goal. And that's what Brian Clark's most recent study did. And he proposes, and this gets to our original point, and I think this is something well worth considering. I'm not sure the Navy will go this direction, but his point is instead of optionally manned unmanned surface vessels, maybe we should just buy small corvettes and put a handful of missiles, sort of arm them comparably with a European frigate, and try to save as much money as we possibly can. But, you know, 15, 20 crew, maximize automation. But ultimately, we need more hulls and we need more missiles, because the missile threat from China is overwhelming, and we just will not be able to throw enough destroyers at it because we'll go bankrupt first.
Yeah, you I put up a post that actually was praising your article on five things you should know about U.S. Navy's plans for autonomous missile boats. And that quote you gave about the wrapping the $2 billion destroyer hull around 96 missile tubes was prominently featured. But you also discussed a program that PEO unmanned and small combatants is mm-hmm. undertaking now to investigate the use of things like this tickled my fancy because I've been writing about it for years, things like offshore supply vessels as potential hulls for the kind of mission you were just discussing. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the Ghost Fleet program, which I want to find out whether that's August Cole and Peter Singer's book's influence in the military. I don't know what came first. I have a theory that it was probably the book, because the program didn't come around until after the book. But the point is, they're getting these OSVs that are used to supply oil fields and sort of offshore oil platforms, and they're throwing autonomous systems on there. And you know what Captain Pete Small will say is that autonomy really isn't the scary thing here. He meets people every day, and they'll come up to him and be like, "Hey, I'm the world's foremost expert on this aspect of autonomous systems, and I've been doing it for 25 years. So this is a mature thing. Autonomous boats, I mean, you know, I remember when I was in the Navy, and they would say, somebody would say, "Well, you have to be really careful with tankers because sometimes the ships drive themselves." And I'm like, "What?" Well, they have a computer that essentially drives the boat. So, you know, yes, autopilots have been on for a while, but ultimately, you know, this is a science that has come along over a number of years, and it's premature. The really scary aspect of this is putting military technology on there, is putting Link 16 capable comms gear in there. It's putting VLS in there. And how do you communicate with it over a long distance? And how do you maintain the boat if it's, you know, I mean, this gear has to go for thousands of miles between maintenance. So, you know, these are a lot of questions, but that is the direction they want to go, I think. They want cheap, commercial, off-the-shelf stuff that they can drop a VLS into and really start upping the number of missile tubes to get at that Chinese threat that we're talking about, and Russia to a lesser extent, but still Russia poses to ships at sea. You need a lot of missiles to counter a lot of missiles. And, you know, you also need mature sort of directed energy stuff to really start driving down the cost curve for combating this missile threat. But ultimately, you're never going to get away from the fact that you need a lot of missile tubes, and we cannot afford to do that. So, yeah, that's the idea, and that's what Ghost Fleet is pursuing, is getting these OSVs and putting military technology on them.
Another way of getting some affordable tubes out there, I would be remiss. Again, I try to fully disclose all my biases. I'm a big fan of the firm, and our Italian buddies at Fincantieri, I'd be interested to see what freebies they had at their booth, but they just delivered the 10th Frem for the Italian Navy, and that's on the short list for our possible FFGX routine. Did you hear any mumblings or rumblings about what the thoughts are on the direction that we want to take? And from your point of view, are any of the options we're looking at more favorable towards being able to get more of those VLS cells per sailor on board whatever ship we select?
Right. So the FFGX is, I think, as I intimated earlier, I think everyone understands we're going to need more than the current requirements of multiple combatants. And I think the sense that I got is that from what Austal is saying, when I went over to their booth, my gut, and from what they're showing there, I don't know that they're going to get the FFGX, but they, I think, will not want for work, because the Navy, with this distributed maritime ops concept, are looking at things like the EPF, Expeditionary Fast Transport, the old JHSV. They're looking at things like that to do inter-theater hospital ships, not the big, you know, honking container type hospital ships. We're talking like inter-theater lift for combat casualties, if we're talking about a Pacific scenario. And they're looking at autonomous vehicles as well. I think the questions around durability of aluminum hull for a frigate class, I think, may be determinative there. I don't know for sure, and I think Austal will tell you they're still very aggressive pursuing that option. Big mystery being Huntington Ingalls, another SNA, and no idea of what they're actually going to submit. They're keeping it very close to the vest, and the Navy has not leaked that to their credit, I suppose. What they're planning on submitting. The Vontia didn't have their model out. I don't know if there's anything to read about that, but their F-100 variant of the Spanish frigate, the Spanish Navy just ordered a new batch of those, so they're doing okay at the moment. But that also, you also start getting into the politics of shipyards and shipbuilding, because we're planning on building a lot of these frigates now, not just the 15 or whatever they're planning for FFGX. I think the general consensus is they're going to be ordering more of them, and I think we'll learn more from the first force structure assessment when it comes out. You start getting into the politics of it. Well, you know, say Fincantieri's yard, Marinette Marine, which is where everyone assumes the FFGX would be built. They've got multi-mission surface combatant. Saudi Arabia just bought that. I think they've got a handful of hulls for that program. So they've got work for the time being. VAF is struggling, or has struggled in recent history, because of the cutback from the DDG 1000. So that might be a consideration. Maybe they go with VAF just so they can ensure that they have enough work to stay a viable shipyard. Certainly with the OMB memo, and I've been told that the OMB memo is not the final word. I think they stressed that things are going to change and that there's movement there. But if they cut the number of destroyers, if they cut five of the flight three DDGs, that would be a huge blow to Bath. especially on top of the Zumwalt cuts, the truncated buy there. So, you know, it's a real moving target, and I know all the competitors really are all in on it. I don't get a sense that any of them are just giving up. But, you know, I think this is going to come down to a lot of politics, frankly, and you know, a lot of consideration is going to be put into, okay, how do we keep all of our shipyards open? Because I think the one thing we can all agree on is losing a shipyard would be really tough if you're trying to build a bigger navy.
Yeah. Hmm. Speaking of DDG 1000, I saw your piece on the handling characteristics, and I heard one of the skippers talk about how well it handled in heavy seas. But we're gonna have three of these things, and once again, you know, is this a ship in search of a mission? Are we looking at three more LCS test bed vessels, but at enormous cost? What
Gosh.
Did and the second thing I want to ask about that is crew size. I mean, I'm worried about being able to operate ships 24/7 if you got, you know, a third of the crew size of a DDG. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, I think they've one of the things I think will be interesting to see about Zumwalt is it achieves a fair amount of automation, but Zumwalt is a single ship, right? And then it's got two sister ships that are coming along. Is the Navy going to change its safety standards to say, okay, well, if you can launch a ship, a boat, say, for example, if you can launch a boat from Zumwalt with just two people, I don't think they can do that by Navy standards, right? You have to have a certain number of personnel there to launch a boat. So they achieve some automation wins, but yet you need a certain number of sailors by Navy standards. I think that's one of the things you could look at. I mean, okay, where can we take risk? If you can physically do it with two people because of the automation features on Zumwalt, maybe we should change some of the standards for that ship especially. But as you know, Navy standards aren't built for carve-outs and special exceptions. So, you know, instead they're probably going to have to start putting all those sailors out there on the boat deck that you would need for a normal boat launch on any other class of ship. So part of this is going to be the Navy learning to trust automation in order to and the Navy kind of learning how to operate with a ship like this. I guess the other questions around that are, you know, for me as a sailor, I'm always thinking about this sort of thing. I mean, in port watches, I mean, I think that's the hardest part about being there. I think everybody understands being underway, right? But if you only have a certain number of people and a certain and you still have all the same security requirements as everybody else, I mean, unless you hire people to stand those watches, you're going to be, what, 3-section duty, 4 max? And that grates on a crew. That makes it pretty hard to be on sea duty if every third day you're standing duty. So you're going to burn out the crew. And, yeah, I talked to a Zumwalt sailor not so long ago, and it said, you know, yeah, the red line for Zumwalt, the red line expectation where you can't go any further is a little higher than anywhere else in the fleet, except maybe LCS, because that we got all the same points there. So, yeah, I think Manning is absolutely a concern, absolutely a concern.
Yeah, I think the dirty secret that's not a secret is the Manning conop for both LCS and DDG 1000 were made at the apogee of that toxic attitude of we're just going to work people to death and then we'll come home, which is exactly the opposite of the lessons, hopefully, the Navy has taken on board from Westpac of 2017. You can't man your ships around perfectly burning people out. That's just not a long way. Not to mention the fact, use USS Cole as a template. How do you fight and save your ship when two of your damage control parties need rescuing themselves? But that's a show into itself. Let's go away for a second from a ship that is a problem to a ship that's not a problem, that's actually on its second leg of life. I think it's become apparent as we wait for Flight 3 to displace water that the Arleigh Burke-class destroyer is going to be the Navy's B-52 that they'll be serving until the crack of doom and then a couple of palms later. And obviously, it's a success, and you build on success when you really don't have any other ones. And wondering if you look at the politics of it, whether I think Eagle One just mentioned BIW, and right now BIW is gifted in a variety of ways. First of all, they build a great ship, but second of all, they have Senator Collins, who is has always exerted a lot of power. But as my friend Claude Barabé pointed out, she's under a lot of pressure on her next election cycle. So some of those things may change. Regardless of the politics, it looks like the program and the math for DDG 51 flight forever looks pretty good. How did things look over at SNA?
As the Arleigh Burke is without a doubt the most. I would say this, and our friend Mark Vandroff might argue because he'll say, well, LPD 17 has been very successful as well. Of course, that's another program that he worked on. But the Arleigh Burke, I think, is the most successful shipbuilding program the Navy has and has had for years and years and years. I believe, and it's my belief, that it's becoming a victim of its own success, right? Because we get to this $2 billion hull around 96 missile tubes. But if it's all we know how to build and it's all we know how to put out, it's a great product, right? It's a great product. And we know how to build it. But if it's all we're doing well, of course we're going to build DDGs. We're going to build a lot of them because we need to build ships. We need to keep those yards open, and we need the capability. We need the hull in the water. And this is where we get back to LCS, right? This is where we get back to the failure of LCS. It was I think people would argue that it was misconceived. And this idea that you needed a super fast ship to guzzle gas to operate in the littorals, well, it just hasn't panned out. And we don't have a ready use for these dozens of hulls. And we could use the support. But Arleigh Burke, for right now, everything I'm hearing is that things are going really well with Flight 3. They're very confident with it. It's I think it's 25%. The first one is 25% done. They're looking to do Aegis light off on Aegis Baseline 10, which is going to integrate air and missile defense, so you can do it simultaneously without having to, do funky things with your combat system. That's going to be scheduled for 2021. It's coming along. These things are everything I heard at SNA was that the key technologies are doing well. And they're already delivering some of the sort of the guts of the Spy 6 radar, which is the sort of the raison d'etre of the Flight 3. Some of the guts are already being delivered to the yards, and so things are going really well for Burke.
Well, that's good to know. Let me ask one more foolish question here, but the SWOs now have their own leather jacket. And I'm just mystified by this, but of course I wore a submariner sweater and I wore a leather flight jacket when I was on active duty, so maybe I shouldn't be too mystified. But what are we doing for our crew, for the sailors? I mean, we keep changing uniforms. Have we got something that people can wear, they can be comfortable in? I mean, I grew up in the days of dungarees and chambray shirts, I think. So,
yeah, here's the thing. I've been an advocate for years now in my limited function that I actually thought the dungarees were great. I didn't have the denim, but we had the essentially Dickies pants and the chambray work shirt. I think those work just fine. If I don't like those, the coveralls work great. I think the Coast Guard, I still not heard a compelling reason from the Navy, if they thought that the uniform was deficient, why they couldn't just use the Coast Guard's uniform. It seems to work. It's functional. I mean, I always thought the blue digicamis, sort of my last great act of resistance in the Navy was my EAOS was before the mandatory switchover date. It was after the mandatory switchover date. I was like, you know, I'm just not buying them. I don't like them. So I'm always proud that I never had to wear that uniform. But ultimately, because I just thought it was silly. We don't need to be reminded that we're in the military. I mean, ultimately, I think the Coast Guard's uniform is good, and I think they've looked at directions like that for the shipboard wear. But they've obviously reinvented the wheel, and they have, you know, their own sort of spin on it, which is, you know, classic Navy. You couldn't just save money. They do the SWO jacket, and I'm still a little mystified as to why, if you're going to give it to SWOs, sailors do get cold as well. If the excuses we need to give people something to wear on the bridge that because it's cold up there or cold in Seattle. I mean, well, sailors are also cold. So I'm not sure why it was just for SWOs. You know, admirals get these ideas, you know, and they think they're great. And who am I to say that they're not? But ultimately, I do not understand why they decided to go with a jacket just for SWOs and not allow sailors to buy it as well if they wanted to. But I think most sailors would just be happy if the Navy settled on a uniform.
I'm in full alignment with you with the Coast Guard thing, and I hope I'm wrong, but part of me says that they won't go that direction for some silly reason. Well, you know, then let's say that we just adopted the Coast Guard. Well, you know what? The Coast Guard, they have ships, and their sailors really don't – their Coast Guardsmen, don't complain about their uniforms. And if you don't want to do that, then get on the phone to the people at Dickies and say, hey, Dickies, in 2 weeks we're going to fly out to D.C. Give me three different options on work uniforms for my sailors to operate between – negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit and 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Your tickets are in the mail, and you know, see what Dickies comes up with. It'd be better than what we have right now, but that is what it is. I wanted to go back. You mentioned our buddy Mark Vandraw. As a program manager, and one of the things they have at SNA is they turn program managers into the ShamWow guy, and Not everybody loves the stage like Mark Vandroff does. Mark, you know, I'm sure he did high school theater or something like that. But talk for a bit about, you know, you can use names if you want to, maybe just to praise the good and, you know, well, damn by not mentioning them other ones. But did you see some of the program managers out there, regardless of the substance of their program, that got that part of the job where you are the ShamWow man? And is somebody the Navy, as we talk about fighting sea blindness by getting the Navy message out there, did you see a couple of program managers that had good stage presence?
Yeah, you know, I think the carrier guys, both of the forward and the future carrier guys, they did a good job. I always think it's funny when they feel like this is a Navy audience, right? They had very long spiels about the value of carriers. And I'm like, well, I mean, we all know. I mean, yeah, I get it. I get it. But, you know, we're all signed up here. If this were the Submarine League, you'd have to argue the value of carriers. But this is Surface Navy. We get it. but I thought they did a great job with their presentations. One of them that did stick out was he's a lovely guy, the guy that does the mission modules for LCS. He's a very funny guy, and he's sort of naturally ebullient and charismatic guy. But he kept on saying, and I'm pretty sure it was only half joking. I'm going to talk as long as possible so that we don't have any questions. And every time somebody would raise their hand, like, oh, no, oh, no. So I think the NAVC program briefs. I will say, here's one thing I'll say about the NAVC program briefs. This is the only, it is NAVC does the Lord's work. And the value of NAVSEA's work, and this is what Mark will tell you, was seen, I think, in spades in 2017 when you saw those two destroyers take enormous hits that would have felled a lesser ship, right? And those ships took a licking and kept on ticking and were able to maneuver and were able to ultimately get home. And of course, you look at things like the Samuel B. Roberts and hitting that mine and still being able to get back to relative safety with their alternative propulsion units. NAVSEA does great work. It is sometimes difficult to get a hold of their program managers if you need them for interviews. And for updates, partly because, the value of the press, I think there's value in spades, but you really do have to have somebody that's convincing them of why it's valuable, because what they'll see is an opportunity to get in trouble. So this is the one time of year that is at SNA and then at Sea Air Space where they kind of let the program managers out of their cage. And meeting the public, and some of them are a little shy, some of them are a little confused about why they're out of their office and in public, and speaking and answering questions from people they don't know. But ultimately, I think it's good and it's valuable to sort of keep the public aware of what's going on.
That's an excellent point. Let me let you talk about yourself for a minute. You've got this excellent thing going on called The Drift. Would you like to tell our listeners how they can get a hold of that valuable piece of data sheet on how things are going in the Navy?
Yeah, sure. The email I do is once a week, and it's on Thursdays mostly, unless I have a weird flight or something. It's on Thursdays, and it'll come out mostly in the evening time when I have a chance to kind of pull notes together. What I do is essentially I compile my notebook, such as it is. I think if you ask my mother how organized is David, she would laugh at you. But I do have notes over various files and in different books and things like that. So I'll pull them all together and chide myself for not being better at this. And I'll pull a piece out and I'll write an introduction, which is usually rambling, if you can imagine from this last hour. Rambles a little bit, goes off in a bunch of different directions, but I eventually do make a point. And so the email experience will be not unlike this. So we'll get to something that's hot in the news, or something that I think needs more attention that isn't getting it. I think one of the things that to toot my own horn, I think one of the things I'm good at is kind of sensing or intuiting what people inside the services are concerned about. And that's kind of what I try to relay in The Drift is okay, here's things that people are thinking about inside the services. And I think that's valuable if you're in industry. It's good to know what the services are worried about, and it's good to know what people are thinking about. And, of course, I have a lot of help. I have a revolving series of people that I talk to, and we'll do Q&As with smart people. I have one coming up with a friend of mine who works up in Philadelphia, sadly a Patriots fan, and living in Philadelphia, which can be dangerous, but he does unmanned systems work, and he's one of the foremost scholars in the country on unmanned systems. He works at the University of Pennsylvania, Michael Horowitz. And we're going to do a Q&A here coming up on unmanned systems, and I'll run it in The Drift. So things like that.
How can people sign up for The Drift?
Sure. It's defensenews.com/newsletters, and it'll be one of the options there. You can just select.
Great. Thanks. Oh, and thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, David, as always, it's a pleasure, and it's great to kick off the year with you. And we'll keep reading you, and have a great week.
Hey, thanks so much, Sal.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next week, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Malone wants to marry me and so leave the strand of-